Okay, so welcome again to the next stage which we have here. Is there any question from your side? So we said at the very end of the last meeting which we had last week, so we said we finish now, we go from the Rig Veda to the Upanishads. So what's the time gap between? Somebody remembers? So, how much time is between the Rig Veda approximately and the Upanishad?
1,000
years? Yes, about 1,000 years. Now we are jumping closer to our times. Yeah, so the Vedanta, we are jumping from the beginning of the Veda, from the Rig Veda to the end of the Veda, the Vedanta. Which is the part of the Upanishads. And again, I remember that, what Müller Ortega said, and what we were discussing last week in a certain way, was that here says the heart here finally becomes quite a symbol and metaphor for consciousness itself. And so chit, it's in a certain way another name for chit. But of course, we had also email discussions on this. I think the battery is empty. One. There is another one here. Let's try this microphone. Hello? Yeah. But of course, if it's not just consciousness, but as I would say, it's a certain way of looking at consciousness. And what would you now summarize in a certain way? Why? What do we mean from the perspective of conscience when we say the heart? We have this whole map which, or diagram which I showed it, and another word which is so crucial for the heart in many texts, that it's the middle, it's the center. Yeah, so it's not just consciousness, but it's in a certain way how we experience consciousness from the middle of consciousness. So it has a middle, and that would be my response of in which way it's consciousness, but also it's consciousness from a certain perspective, which I would translate into European traditions as Munah. Yeah, so I think here Leibniz really has. And Aurobindo, for example, at one time, of course, Abhinav Gupta cannot speak about Western philosophies, but Aurobindo can since he lived in the 20th century. So he says if one would have translated this explicitly on one part, that it would be the monad in Western philosophies. So the monad, and as I said, the body is the center of the monad. That would be my explanation. And so when we have this axis of the nervous system, as we would say, of the spine, this is again the center in the center of the body. So if you ask me which answer I would give, where is the heart located? And this brings us closer now to the Upanishad. Where is the heart located in yourself? It is your spine. So that would be. So it's the channel of all the nerves which are going through the central axis of your spine. And this axis is in a certain way the stick, as the tantric would say. It's the stick within your body, and your body is the center of a world. Yeah. So when I say monad again, I mean the body is not ending at the surface of your three dimensions, but as Leibniz in European philosophy, so he introduced in modern philosophy again this old term of the monad, it's really that my body now is the center of a world, so my body does not end at the surface of my body. That's exactly the wrong perception of the body, which we have usually that it's ending here. But as a Leibmonade, as I would call it in German, as it is the monadic, as the body is the center of the world, it means that you are, in a certain way, who are sitting here, part of my monad. So, in the Leibnizian sense, you are inside of myself as a being in the world, but you are outside of the three-dimensional cubic dimension of my body. So from, of course, if I understand body only as something that ends at the surface of its form, then you are outside of myself. But you are still in my world. And if you also, as long as you are in my world, you are part of my monad. Yeah, so I share, you share the world with myself. Yeah? And so we are, you are in myself if I perceive myself as me. And here that's very important, so that we never, and I said it also with other passages from which I have quoted, and of course this is then a big question, this should be my next research project also, which I will apply it exactly on the relation what you asked once, I think 2 hours again. So how is the relation to what we usually in daily life today would mean that it's a human organ? Yeah? So how does this monadic perception relate to the anatomic perception of the heart, which most of the people today would probably have? If I speak of the heart, they would point somewhere here. Yeah? It's an organ within my human body. Yeah? And so that's a question then, how does this anatomic heart relates to the monadic conception of myself. So, there, but this is what was strong, a conclusion of, in a certain way, of all the first hours, that this is not just an organ within the body. Genau. So I made last time one, I was at the end starting with this, but I skipped one fold, one slide. So I go back to this. So the one head with, where he really says at the end it has to do much more with what in Europe is called consciousness than with an organ. Yeah. And we go now to this one of an early Upanishad. I just give you smaller outlines to make Yosh Upanishad one meeting today, and next meeting we would all jump again 1,000 years nearer, closer to our thing, and go to Kashmir Shalins. Yeah? So we are always jumping about 1,000 years, quite big steps, which we are doing here in time. Yeah? What's that?
What does Upanishad mean?
It's literally meaning sitting on the feet of somebody. So this is still a gesture which is produced today. If you are in very orthodox circles, they will kiss the feet. I don't want to do it. But you would kiss the feet of your guru. So literally it's called sitting nearby the feet of your teacher. Yeah? Sitting close. And of course, this has a very symbolic meaning also. Yeah? But still, when I was in Tamil Nadu, so we were working at Adi Shakti, which is close to Pondicherry. This is an artist place, yeah, where the very famous artist group, Adi Shakti Theatre Group, is working. Ivan was there also. And I was there for 3 months, for example. And when you went to the next place, which is a very famous, now became one of the most famous tantric places, only so it's the next ground. And there you have martial art classes, and usually the people in the morning kiss the feet, symbolically they do a kind of gesture of kissing the feet of the Lord. So this is still going on today in certain, this today would be politically far right, of course this is an official BGP supported place, and So you don't have to think that in all India they kiss the feet of the ditch. But in the BGP surrounding, you can still, for example, you can still find this. So that's literally sitting close to the feet of the teacher.
Sorry, but not only in the BGP context, because in every ashram it's usually...
Yes, and sure, but VGP is very connected to many ashrams. this is a close connection to many of the ashrams. But of course, this is what they try to bring in, the whole Swamis, also again into the political field. So the ashrams, for me, it's very problematic because this means that we have a kind of very dangerous, I think, symbiosis of spiritual practice with official public politics. So we have exactly that kind of fusion that is going on, which most, if you look into the history of human history, this is usually quite a dangerous constellation. Yeah.
Is it this feet kissing, is it the same symbolism as in Christianity? Or does it have a different meaning? Is it just a respect?
Yes, of course, if you have it just in a certain way, it's a gesture of respect. So if I de-dramatize it, yeah, it's just a kind of... But my yoga teacher, yeah, who is very famous, Sastry, would have absolutely not wanted to be kissed on the feet. So Desika Chali was very critical about such kind of gesture. So, and he is really one of the very big names in 20th century yoga philosophy, but he had only one stature, and this was one nice Patanjali stature, and this was all. Yeah. So you found it much more oriental and esoteric science if you go to a yoga center, usually here in India, than I found there. In this place where I've been, but of course if I would have been in other places, these things could happen. But I have my reasons why I was not so much interested in this art. But of course, so do you have this kind of guru, classical thing? And of course if you want to see it less critical than I did now, it's a gesture of high respect. And you know that's something very different to this is maybe strange for you, but you know, in many texts it said there is first God, then your mother, and then your teacher. Because education, and this has to do a lot with their thing, it's with their philosophical also approach. So why do they have philosophy much longer than we? So we have, as I said, 4,000 or 5,000 years. We have 2,500 in the continental sphere. Because it is connected, that's my theory, because philosophy is connected to salvation. This is not just we are doing a little bit theory. But in a certain way, it's really a matter of the heart. To get education is the highest thing what can happen. This is a beautiful faith. This is something special that you are educated. You know, we go to university, probably to have a good job, course. But that's very different. If you go to a teacher that has to do with lucky Plato, huh? This is not so far, but we had the same in Plato. This was the birth of the Academia, which is the birth of the university. In Plato, you were living at the Academia with the people. And in India, for example, if you have a guru, which just represents the teacher, you are learning a musical instrument. You would strongly, your whole life probably be connected. Because learning a musical instrument is never only learning music, but it's a spiritual practice. So you are closely connected to your teacher. So what, to have good and the right teacher is one of the most important things you have, can have, one of the most biggest gifts you can have in your life. So education is the privilege because it is really connected to salvation. So if, very classic, if you go to a yoga, if you have Patanjali classical yoga thing, it says that you have 8 steps of praxis, dasanga yoga. And the first seven is just to get the right way of how should I say, viveka khyati. So it's that you learn to distinguish viveka, make a difference, make to settle. So you are not doing asanas, you are not as body postures or breathing postures. Why do you do this according to very tradition? And why do you read the texts? Because you want to have viveka here. You want to get the knowledge how to distinguish rightly between being and time. This is why I became so popular in the East. Because the distinction between what is being eternal in a certain way and what is temporal, that is needed for your salvation. And this distinction is the effect of a praxis that is in a certain way deeply connected with philosophy. Only the 8th anga is going beyond this. But, and of course, if European and Western people just, oh, the 8th anga is the only one, so Zen and this kind of thing, yeah, where you try to overcome the duality that is in the this on the world of distinction. We have to say, okay, don't be satisfied with the first 7, start with the 8. But that is, I would say, a typical gesture of white supremacy. So you are born in order to say to go to a directly to the last step and to the ultimate. But the first 7th step is really about the realization to distinguish, this is explicitly said, avidya, so the most stubborn obstacle you can only overcome through right judgment. You have to learn to distinguish properly the realms. And so that way is for them not just a theory, but viveka, in a certain way, viveka khyati, intuitively seeing, yeah, coming from seeing the difference between the realms, that is one of the last steps on the ladder of salvation. Only the very last step below. And of course, people have a tendency to start with the heart. And they don't want to go through the whole ladder before. So they start with 10 and all this kind of thing of not thinking, of not reflecting. But you have to be highly developed if you start with this. Yeah? Because this means that you have a sense that you don't need the first 7 steps. That can be. Yeah, sometimes this is right, but very often I think it is very hyper ego that demands to start with the last and highest. Okay, so that's this. So I go now, also that's to the Upanishad. Yeah? So we go now to one early Upanishad, and I just read one of these quotes. In the Upanishads, we begin to read about the space within the heart. So here I already would say this, I would not read this as, they speak about the space. And then we now think of, so most people would say this is something like the heart space. Yeah? But again, for me, I use the word space in Indian philosophy as in a certain way, as a tattva, as a principle. So if you, the heart is in the first place a space, and this does not mean it's just a space in my body, but it's a plane, as you have said. So the heart is in a certain way a plane. So it's you are sitting in the space. So you are sitting in the space of the heart. So it's not just in my body, but it is one of the planes in which are in the matrix of the space. So that would be. So this the space within the heart. One of the earliest of these texts, the Brihadaranyaka, declares that all sensory perceptions are gathered and united in the heart, and that it is in the heart that one is said to rest during sleep. So this is why I've chosen this. I think the first thing is very common. We could say, aha, Böhler is totally wrong, because obviously here it is said, it is that which brings to so the gathering, the collection of the sense data, which usually is also very much connected to manas, yeah, to the mind, yeah, in a certain way. But I will then find some arguments which we should not be too quick. Yeah? So I would call this, this is a response to the last meeting, that I said, when we do intercultural philosophy, we have two options. One is that we think they were stupid. So, this is primitive barbaric thinking, it makes no sense for us, therefore it's stupid. This would be the colonial approach, and the other, which I did not express, but it came into my mind that I've forgotten to use this, to share this phrase. The otherness, which is very Western for me, but good, is its laziness of thinking. So we have a tendency that we are very rigorous in reading Western philosophers, but we are lazy when it comes to other cultures. And this means that we don't see a real challenge. So we need the space of the heart. Okay. I think this is a big problem. That probably they mean really the space, and not just the space inside of my body. So this is what I would call laziness of denkfaul, as you say. So philosophers can be several things, but they really should not be lazy in things. Yeah? So that's really your profession, that you should not be lazy in thinking. That means that you really take these things as a challenge and not just as something that is evident and given. So the first thing is quite clear. Okay, the heart seems to be something like a common sense in the old sense, because the word common sense is very much used in modern Anglo-Saxon philosophy, but it is much earlier used in certain traditions of philosophy when I say that I think what Aristotle coined this again of aesthesis koine. And that aesthesis koine means really not just common sense. So if we have common sense, it means something like today in modernity, it means something that, oh, we agree to certain things. But koine aesthesis in Aristotle is first, as the word says, it is a problem of aesthesis. So it's a heart problem. Okay. Yeah? It's a way of sensing sensuality. It's not just aesthesis, it's not just sensing rata, but it is sensing sensuality, aesthesis, so sensual perception, which I sense, and in sensing sensitive data in a certain way, they are a koine. And this koine is usually the Gemüt. So the Gemüt, the German word for Gemüt, is exactly a translation of this koine aesthesis from Aristotle. So it's that in which all the sensual data come together in a sense. Yeah? It's aesthesis. It's not just sensual data, but it's when the ear Here's a sound. Of course, it is sensing the data that are in the room. Yeah? But aesthesis means not just the data, but it's the hearing of the data in sensing the senses, the vibes in the space. Yeah? So if someone is playing music or Arno is speaking here, he's creating sense data, but your ear is not just getting the sense data. For example, when you are in a coma, you are also getting the sense data, but you are not sensing it. Because you are not, as Kant would say, it's no app perception. You are not with the sensing of the data. But in aesthesis, in sensual perception, you are with the data, with your sense. So it's a matter of consciousness sensing the sensual data. This is aesthesis, and therefore it's a form of perception. This is beautiful in German. It's a way of wahrnehmung. Yeah? And Aristotle, for example, in the Anima, asked them, can they make a mistake? And Aristotle thinks not. Very interesting, because usually we say, oh, sense data can betray you. And then there comes the stick in the water, yeah, and you see it as if it would be broken, and then you have it, and this is usually said, okay, so sensual sensation, aesthesis does betray you. Or you see the sun as a small point, yeah, but in fact it is much bigger than you see. But Aristotle exactly said this is not right, because the ear has a clear reference to the sound waves, and the eyes has a very clear reference, so you don't have to tell your ear which spectrum of waves does it read and sense. It has a clear reference to a certain acoustic spectrum, as we would say today, which the ear is alluding to as the sense data. It does sense, and what you hear is never the sense data, but you hear the way how you perceive and how you, and this is not difficult to say, yeah, it's the aesthesis connect, yeah, it's the common sense, the gathering of all these aesthetic experiences. So we would rather have to translate common sense not in the modern sense of most Anglo-Saxon philosophies, but I would translate it with the modern word of synthesis. This is also exactly Greek. Yeah? Synesthetic. So the heart is the place of synesthetic experience. So in the heart, the sense data of your ear, the sense data of your visual experience, the sense data of your taste, the smell, they all come together, are synesthetically coming together in the ground of your, and here really we have in German the better word, because heart is now difficult, but the German word, I think, of Gemüt, of mood, is exactly what. So it's a mood, and the mood is the gathering and the collection, the legen, the logos. Yeah, the Greek legen, it is bringing together as a synthesis, koine aesthesis, all the sense data and bring them together, and thus, in a certain way, give us a sense of the synthesis of all these sense. So what we feel in the Gemüt, in the heart, in a certain way, is already a synesthetic experience of all the senses, which you first gather in a feeling. You feel or you taste all these sensual experiences. I have a taste, I have a Geschmack of what is going on. And this would not just mean that I bring together my experience of the what I hear, of what I see, but I in certain way collect all this and have a synesthetic experience of gathering So that would be my the first part of this reading. The second reading, so translating a lot of contemporary philosophies, of course, but this is why I really touch on philosophy. So I'm not just taking reading in a historical or museal way, but I try to find translations. A united heart, and that is the heart that one is said to rest during sleep. This is why I wanted to have this passage. So that's, I think, this is quite fascinating for me. This was many years I was thinking about this, because this broke me when I first read it, because usually we know I'm in a waking state, hopefully you are all in a waking state right now, and you're not sleeping too much. But I don't, maybe even worse, I make you sleep in a certain way. But we have Freud and we have the Traumdeutung, so we know there is a waking state and there is a sleeping state. I always wondered why they have such an emphasis on the state of deep sleep. Why is it so? Not just so, they never say deep. Usually not say sleep, because that would just be the dream state, but deep sleep, so when you are too tired to dream, as Nietzsche was. Nietzsche says, in the deep sleep you are too tired. He's always so provocative. He says, in deep sleep you are even too tired to dream. So that's his very negative interpretation about the deep sleep. But here, in a certain way, it's very interesting that they have the theory, obviously, that the first thing, and this is coming in many texts, we have it in the tantric texts, the same thing. So this is even almost 2,000 years later, 1,500 years later, you still have these problems. This is so fascinating in a certain way, but in the culture is recording what is said. The recording of text, where in a certain way through giving the text to the next generation, they have a special topics, the way of having these records, which you can, I don't know any culture. So as you said once, from the pre-Socratic times, we have probably a small library, so that goes from here to here, This is all what we have today from the pre-Socratic philosophy. And then you come to India and you would fill this room several times. They have kind of Ach. They have a special technique developed of how to store things. And it's very interesting that only small part of this story goes through writing a text, but goes through an oral tradition. So by learning text by heart. So that is one of the main copying systems in this culture, which makes it very strange. And still today, the good and the bad sides of the system we have really experienced when we were living here. So that, because it's really for us, it makes it all for us, I include myself. It's really impossible to say something because the written word does not count the same as spoken. So if you had made a contract with an Indian and 1 week later you are speaking with him and you say something different, the contract is over. This makes it really a very, very language or scriptural language. Yeah? And they are still, they think the phony. There they are really on the other side of the river. They really think that the spoken language is higher than the written. And this makes for, this is why people don't want to make business with it. Because in a certain way, a business usually today goes over contracts. And the contract does not really come for them out of their tradition, because the next day you speak with them. And you have discussed, oh, so let's forget the contract. And this is for us, really, but we have written it and you have signed it. But today we said something different. And that's really very deep in this culture. This was for me one of the biggest differences still today, if you live with that. That's very strange for us.
Is this also in the legal system? Actually the case, so would it be
don't think, because the legal, I'm no expert of the legal system, but this is more or less a copy of the British system. So still today you have on the legal political label more or less a British constitution, not only because the British were the colonial people who brought all this constitution to them, but the Ambedkar, who was, by the way, a Dalit. Yeah? So the lowest caste or no caste person, but he had the possibility to study law in England. And he then came there. He, by the way, converted to becoming Buddhist because he was against the caste system. So he could also have become a tantric, because many tantrics are also against the caste system. And so he did study law in England, and so it's not just that the British gave them the law, but also after independence, they in a certain way even more ran. The constitution is founded on British law, so that's the other thing. But I'm not expert, I cannot speak about details, how much. But I could think if VGP is really ruling the land for longer, and he's quite now long, the powerful man, the Prime Minister Modi, so then this is everywhere trying to make a Hindu Dwap constitution. So this will be one of the big struggles in 23rd century India. Because this is always what I say, you know. Here you have left-wing activists who use the word decolonial and all this. But for the real powerful people, yeah, like Prime Minister Modi, use this word exactly to write a new constitution that is no more found on the British. It's not just in a copy of British law. So for these people, decolonize the country means that go back into the 16th century before the two big occupations of the British and the Muslim, which for them is even longer and stronger way of occupation. For today, I'm just, this is not my opinion, but this is their interpretation. And so I'm quite sure that within the next, so I'm trying to answer to your question, so I'm quite sure that the next 20 years, if they still keep the power, they started in part to change the constitution, but they would like to create a Hindu constitution. And that would mean that they want to have a constitution that is strongly inspired by two big historical phases in India, by the Ashoka phase starting, so between the 3rd and the 5th century, 3rd century before our time to 5th century our time, and then 8th century to 13th century, the big Kashmir Shaivism time also, where in a certain way a Buddhist or Brahmin culture was ruling India. And all the other times, they would say in the last 2,500 years, foreigners, as they say, have ruled this country. And so decolonizing means to go back to these times where really Hindus like Buddhists and tantrics in a certain way have ruled our country, and not the northern Aitavrika, to say political correct, and the Muslims and the British. So they were the strongest occupier for them. For them, this would be 100 years of occupation. And this is why we have to be aware that there is a big resistance coming from India once they have gained economic power. And as I said, if you look into the post-colonial discourse, the really worldwide biggest stars, most have a background from India. Because this is really like something we have now and we have the Gaza conflict, we especially as German Austrian, we cannot think of this without the history we have, for example, with this. And for them, the colonial topic has this significance. It's the trauma of this country. And it therefore reacts strongly on the question of colonialism. So you cannot do decolonize. You have two, I think, which are the mainstreams of decolonial thinking. But they, you know, are mostly on the very right. This is total wrong perception, what we have right now here. They are on the very right political spectrum. They are not at all on the left spectrum. And this is India and South America, of course. Yeah, the two areas on this globe, and of course Middle East, Africa. But these are the areas which have the trauma of colonialization strong. And India is obviously the population biggest. And from this, Africa has so many countries, but India still tries, and that's a big thing Modi tries to do, to create one nation like China, which has never been in the Indian tradition. Yeah.
Sorry, but you referred to the Gaza conflict, but actually it was a terrorist attack on Israel. So it's not the Gaza conflict.
Yeah, I think it's a both side conflict. There is the one thing that we have the Gaza, of course we have the terror attack on the side of the Hamas, yeah, which obviously was terror and nothing else than terror. But we have also a long, long tradition of history that is going. And I see it very dangerous, as many see it, that we don't think, we have to think, this is the same with the Ukraine-Russian district. I think it's very dangerous to think a causality that is not thinking also and taking the whole historical context. You cannot think of colonialization in India as they would say, if you have Savarkar, the ideology of Hindutva, he starts his ideology with the whole historical narrative of more than 2,000 years, 2,500 years. So you cannot reduce Hindutva just to what they are doing today. I think this is not possible, because if you see from where Hindutva is born, it's a historical narrative. If you read Hindutva, you cannot reduce it to just what is taking place today. And I quote here Judy Butler, the whole emancipation, the thing, I am somebody in a certain way trained from Judy Butler. Yeah? So the whole big thing, what she is saying about feminism, is that feminism has to be seen in a historical perspective. This is one of the big things what Judy Butler, who is on the very left, has said. You cannot say women are just doing this today. You have to see the history that is behind this way of how women has been treated for such a long time. You cannot reduce it to what is going on in this here and now. And especially this is impossible to think from an Indian perspective. Because karma, in a certain way, comes from the root kri, which means doing. Acting, but you can never understand your act without knowing the history from where this act and action comes. So the action is not coming just ex nihilo. And this is what I would say. So we cannot isolate an act from the sedimentation of a history that in a certain way drives these acts. And that is a very general philosophical thing. That is a virtue, and I'm very skeptical if we start to not accept this way of thinking, that we reduce an act to just being an act without having a ground that is grounded in a certain way, in certain ways of this. So that is, and especially in the context of Indian philosophy, it is impossible. And of, that would be this.
Sorry, but it's the same to the butler that signed a letter claiming Israel is responsible for the terrorist attack on 7th October.
No, but that is, I read her article. I read her article. And the first thing what she said is that she was writing against the attack of Hamas. That was the first sentence. So first sentence is that she said that, okay, I am, by the way, of course she's Jewish. Of course she's Jewish. So we are speaking of, obviously, of a perspective from a Jewish woman who has been directly been involved in the whole history and has devoted up to a certain degree her whole philosophy in order to think and reflect the Shoah. Nobody can say something else. She starts her article, which is simply not true, with a first rejection of what the Hamas did. But then she started that one also has to see this in a historical context. And I think that when an intellectual, a Jewish intellectual, is saying that first attacking the Hamas, what Hamas did, that this is a crucial act of terror. But then saying we should also see this act in a historical perspective, I think this is intellectually right.
Morally not.
That's your opinion.
Yes, it's my opinion, of course, my opinion. That's why I speak.
Can we move on to a different topic,
please? Sorry?
Your opinion,
can we please move on to a different
topic? Okay. So, but that's my statement. So that's one thing. So we had this. This is very important for me. So why did they connect the heart with the condition of deep sleep? That is very important for me. So in a certain way, even in latex, in the tantric context, you have the saying that technically spoken, the heart is there where we reside when we are in a dreamless state of consciousness, because that's important for them. Deep sleep is not just I am unconscious, but deep sleep is the state in which I approach and be in a certain layer of consciousness itself. So I'm not leaving myself when I sleep. That would be my formulation. Even when you sleep, you are not leaving yourself. Yeah? So you are still in the layer of yourself. That is very important for that. So you are unconscious, but you are not out of yourself. Usually they then also say there are two states that distinguish when you are in a deep sleep. A deep sleep means always you are in a status where you don't dream anymore. Yeah? So every night they would say you are going through circles, so you come from the waking state, and from the waking state you go back to the dreaming state and the dreaming self, and then there comes a phase in the circle of sleeping in which you in a certain way are no more dream. And this is always what were deep sleep for them. And they usually then distinguish it. And there they say, so you are going back in a certain way. And I found this a fascinating and interesting theory. They say, When you are losing your consciousness, you are in a certain way going back into deep sleep, and there you are now in the space, that's what we did, you are now in the space of your heart. Huh? I found this interesting. And then they distinguish usually between two states. So one state is when we say, oh, I had a sound deep sleep. So what does this mean? So you are not dreaming, but you are now on a very basic layer of yourself, and you say, oh, I had a sound deep sleep. What could this mean?
Grounded on the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. That would be. This is why I said I would exactly, when I go back to the Vedic time, I would exactly say you are now. So what we had in the diagram. So this whole phallic erection, in a certain way, this rakini, is now going back in a certain way and going into the ground in the lower ocean, yeah, of deep sleep. In a certain way, and when you say with sound, it means that something is still there which regenerates you. Yeah? So if you go into deep sleep, they would say after you dream, yeah, you are in a phase where you don't know anything, but still something is regenerating you. Yeah? There is still a kind of activity in deep sleep which you feel the next morning when they are, oh, I'm relaxed. So they would call this now, it was simply the pulse. I'm still trying to find out what they mean with heart. You know, that's the whole thing of the thing. I don't know yet. I'm trying to find out. But obviously, when they say you are going into the heart, it's obviously that you are going on that level where something new, in a certain way, there is still a little activity in it which is relaxing yourself. Yeah. So when you wake up, you say, oh, I had a good deep sleep. Yeah. And then they would say there is also even a deeper level in at the bottom of your heart. This would be my way of taking it. So at the bottom of your heart you have this true thing where even this activity is fading away and you are in a certain way of nirvana. This is also a term which they often use. So it's like in this way you are in nirvana, but the problem, what makes the distinction between these way of being in the heart of deep sleep and nirvana would be that in nirvana you are awakening into this deep sleep. So you are not losing your consciousness, but you are still there. You are still at perception. Your consciousness is still there in this highly relaxed state. Yeah? This is at least how they, very many of the texts do interpret. So obviously here, again, as you said, the heart now in this context, this is why I have this diagram, here it does not so mean to be in the middle of this upright, more main-like direction, yeah, this phallic direction, as you say, but you are really going down into the yoni direction, yeah, into the lake of the unconscious, and there you are now in a certain way, every night when you have, when you go into this deepest level of your sleep. And this is also why I would say they have this strong thing of Japan and Asian cultures, why they have this strong sleep culture. Yeah? So this is why, in a perverse, for me, perverse way, companies are using this in Japan in order to give you a nap room in order to shortly regenerate so that your work power will be stronger afterwards. So having this 20-minute naps, regain energy and regenerate yourself. You had a question.
I just thought maybe can understand with Plato when he's talking about dreaming, or that like bad people are actually dreaming, or like people with bad consciousness, that they are like being reminded of their doings, and when they're not dreaming, so when they're like really deep sleep without dreaming, that you're kind of a good man, because you are like in peace with yourself. So being in the heart, maybe understood as like being in peace with yourself. Or
yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think I'm also not just trying here to give some introduction to the Indian philosophy, but as I said, many say, and I share this estimation that Plato was the last philosopher, because last is relative. In a certain way, Plato was the last archaic philosopher which we had. Yeah? So Plato is so important because he's exactly at the edge where we go into something else, where mythology and so suddenly is over, and logos, that's the classical thing, takes over. But in Plato we have still both things. Yeah? So he has still a knowledge of how, in a certain way, the archaic and mythological way of thinking did work. And we still today have this. This is not so far away if you think, for example, of Freud, that he would also say, when you are dreaming, wir verarbeiten. So that's a very interesting word, actually. So wir verarbeiten our past, our memories. And of course, this is exactly what this would mean. So if you were not finished with your labor during the day, you have to work it through in your dream life. Yeah? Because you have not digested. I think this is the best word for me. This is, of course, enriched. So if you have not digested your day, or if you are haunted by any of these traumas, which we were spoken. Yeah. So the traumatic is here very important. This is why trauma in German is even so close. Yeah. If you have traumatic experience, they will hunt you through the dreams. This is exactly Freud. Yeah. This is the very central Freud. He started with trauma and trauma theory. Yeah. So the dream in German is very close to the trauma, even from the world. So that's exactly where I would put this, what you said about Plato and many archaic culture, that as long as you are haunted by your traumas, you cannot come into your heart space. That's for me the heart space. Yeah? You do not come into your heart space because you come not in that relaxation where you can, in a certain way, free you from your traumatic experience. It will haunt you, as Derrida says. Yeah? It will haunt you from the back. Yeah? And it will trigger your dream life. So the stronger the trauma, the more traumatic, the more difficult it is to leave your memories behind. Because that's exactly going when you are going into the heart. Also, by the way, this is very interesting coming to you next. Just one more remark. In tantrism, as you will see, they use exactly these same friends. Yeah, they use exactly 1,500 years later, almost the same words. They say in the Heart Sutra, for example, in the Shiva Sutra 115, the Heart Sutra, they would say that if you come to this place, which they identified obviously with this very deep level in yourself, where you are even undoing your memories, because as long as you dream, they would say with Freud exactly the same theory, that your memories are triggering the dreams. So if you have bad memories like a trauma, they will trigger, they will show up in the dreams. That's the whole theory of Freud. This is the unconsciousness. How do you get, how can you know about your unconscious? You have to meet it at dream conduct. Yeah? And now what they say in the Heart Sutra of 115 of the Shiva Sutra, they say explicitly, then the caste system, this is why I always say not just Buddhist but tantric philosophy are not accepting the caste system because of their concept of the heart. In 115 it is explicitly said, if you come to this place, castes do no more matter. So it's a very political thing, what this concept of the heart, because there was, as long as you are on the dreaming stage, and as long as you are in the wake state, social, let's use the soft word for caste, hierarchical social difference do matter. But if you come to the deep heart space, yeah, which they obviously identify with this deep sleep state, then the social, political categories of the caste system fade away. It is explicitly said in the Heart Sutra. That's also a very political concept which we have here. Yeah? These things, because it even argues them, because these are social constructs. And since the social constructs fade away, the caste system fades away. I always like this 150 sutra. Sorry, so you first and you thank me.
Is there in any text also a reference to like the bodily reactions to deep sleep? Because for us we know heart rate drops to like 40 per minute and the breathing is deeper than we have it during the day and stuff like this. Is there any like stuff on that or?
Yeah, you said the crucial word, it's the breathing. So you know we have measured and we have externalized the measurement of how to we then have a machine who sees what are the, I think it's the alpha waves, if I'm right, this one, which they would say, which you have when you are in this deep sleep, and they have a certain frequency. We measure this with machines, usually, yeah, in our culture. It's not a bad thing. But they had other techniques, and the techniques they use is the breathing. So in order to come down to these deep layers, they had developed infinitely many practices of breathing, pranayama. So through techniques of breathing, there is a stairway, we can consciously awake into these deeper layers. It's the breath system that in a certain way has access to these deeper layers of the heart. So this is why they have extensively developed techniques of breathing. So instead of using machines and externalizing, their theory was that when, for example, when you, they would say, if you are, let's say, if I'm right, no dream, researcher, but I think as far as I heard, let's say this is the alpha phase. I have it somewhere in the back. I think I read it somewhere. But this is no, I cannot promise that. But let's call it the alpha phase in which we are, right, when we are in this status of deep sleep. When you are there, they would say in a certain way, the other sheets of you are falling away. And you, in a certain way, can now, through certain breathe technique, Buddha, awake into this deep sleep. This is the fight between the Hindus and the Buddhists. The Hindu very often would say the Buddhist is nihilistic because they want to go into this deep sleep. And they would always claim this is still a state of yourself. tell me, how is it possible to experience nirvana when you are no more there? So this is usually their argumentation. So even nirvana cannot be an anatman, it cannot be without yourself. If it's not without yourself, so how can you experience it? If you experience it, is no anatman, but it is atman. So that would be their argumentation. And they would say through certain pranayama techniques, through certain breathe techniques, we can awake even into this thing. So we can consciously apercept, in a second, be with this state which others do not experience in the conscious sense because they lose consciousness when they enter this state. So this is a state that is without myself. And this goes very close to Kant again. Yeah? So I lose in a certain way my empirical self, but I am still there in a kind of, yeah, Kant uses the word, I don't like it at all. He's not good at language. He's a really good thinker, but he has no feeling for language. So he calls it transcendental, of course, transcendental. Yeah, I don't like it because this is too religious. This is too close to very Christian ways of seeing God as something transcendent and not immanent. This is not transcendent, but this is much more going immanent into myself. So from the Indian context, it's dead. I would say, yeah, to the records.
My question was, how does the caste system fade away in this deep state? I have like an intuition, maybe it's false, but I had this impression this deeper ocean, Murapakiti, is the place of indifferentiation, where there is no real difference between the beings. That's why I was asking your question. This question.
Exactly. In a certain way, it goes to Advaita. Yeah. So to say, there is no more a differentiation or differentiations become a surface. This would be my interpretation, because otherwise we are going into this dangerous ocean without a wave picture. I don't like it at all. I think it's totally wrong. So, but I would say, because all these from there, when we arise from this ocean, they would say all differentiations become surface effects. There is something deeper in differentiation that is grounding the differentiations. Yeah? So it's indifference. But indifference has something to do with differentiation. But it's in a certain indifference is the grounding of difference, and in that way difference becomes a surface before we identify with difference. But here we stop to identify with the difference. We don't see us primarily as Austrian. Even we don't see us primarily as a man. Also, these things are not going away in the way that they make are not significant, but if you go into your center and enter that space, as they would say, the heart space, then this becomes differentiation of indifference in a certain way. And so you now see the different, you are not, this is for me, the other way would be fascist. Yeah? So you are now, just now going into indifference. And then Hegel would say, but this cannot be the true ultimate, because then it has an outside, which are the differentiations. Yeah? So it's the opposite of the differentiation. And Hegel would say, this is the bad, this is the Die Nacht in der alle Kühe schwarz. Yeah? But it's the thing, the theory for me deeper is that you can enter within all these differences into a heart space in which these differentiations become äußerlich. Before they were innerlich, because you identified. But the heart space gives you a way of having an empty space. This is why this is me. In this case, it is the omen. Very often it's shunyata. The heart is that empty space that opens differentiation. Yeah, for me. That is not just the opposite, because when you have the opposite, it's the duality thinking which you take into this. So there is a lower ocean, this is the opposite of all the others. But it's not the opposite, it's the center. It's the middle, in the middle of all the differentiations, there is this open space. Lacan, if you like. This is very Lacan psychoanalysis. French psychoanalysis. That you have always this open space, this lack in the middle that is still not occupied, if I take the political space. You still, if you don't have this space, you are identifying with the occupied space.
But isn't that similar to the Buddhist conception where the center of the self is empty?
Yes, that's of course. You should not, the biggest thing that you should not become academic scholar in this. They need distinguish, they have to distinguish in order to, and they started to distinguish Hindus from them in order to sort out these things. Buddha was a Hindu. You cannot imagine all what Buddha says without the background of the Hindu culture. So that's something like, oh, being a Buddhist means being no Hindu. This is probably good for an academic book, but it's simply not true. It can be written in a book, but that's in a certain way for probably an introduction into something. But this is really not true. They share at least 90% of their presumption. And there is only small things where they start to argue, like in Europe, struggle between schools. And then they suddenly become an identification. Oh, I'm a Buddhist, I'm no Hindu. And the Hindu says, I'm Hindu, I'm no Buddhist. These are exactly not what the scripture says. They have lost the empty space. That would exactly, they have lost their heart. They have lost their heart. Because they have started to identify with social construction. Like being Austrian. And this kind of stuff. And this is why we need the heart as the emptiness, the place of the omen is literally the ether, the ether of the empty space. Yeah, you can shunya. If you lose that not occupied space, you will fall in trouble because you identify yourself with certain constructs which have been constructed. And there, in a certain way, now really the eight anga, zen, and all this becomes important. Because how can I existentially now, I as Arnold, living in this world of constructs, how can I free myself from my identification with this construct? That's now quite sudden, very existential thing for everybody. Because that identification with these constructs is quite natural for us. It's quite natural, we have to identify. And then the Indian traditions come netty. Yeah, that's one thing. Because if you don't have this, you lose, as Lacan would say, if you don't just bring it in there. If you lose that empty space in yourself, you are in the danger to identify with it. something. Yeah? And then you lose your heart. Yeah? You are falling out of your center. You are losing your heart. You are losing exactly that empty space because you have started to fully identify. Yeah? If you fully identify, you become fanatic. Fanaticism is when you start to, for them, when you start to fully identify with something. And then you have lost your heart because you have lost the inner empty space. So that's a little bit logic. And that's important for me to remember again when you speak about the heart in the heart. So how can I, it's that capacity also of non-identification, you know, which is the center again, what you said so correctly, of Buddhist practice. And this is why this emphasis, you know, before we identify with the gods and the highest, and vijnana, maya, and having the absolute knowledge, we should, before we do this, we should, kenosis in Christianity, we should empty hearts. Because that opens the space of the heart. That would be my reading of these texts. That you have your own intelligence and can well know whether there is something true or not true.
Would you say that this identification is more of a Western phenomenon?
Time right now, Julia, I will not say that this is typical. I think that they have similar techniques from their history again. They have developed techniques, cultural techniques, stronger than we to not identify. But this does not mean, you know, today India is high capitalistic, globalized, more or less. I said it changed totally dramatically from the 80s when I was there to today. If you travel to India, you will meet a globalized country which is no more attacked twice. It's just been 45 years ago. You were rarely traveling in other times. So. But in the middle of the 90s, India opened economically and mentally to the West. All the big pressure from the West, mainly through moral arguments. They are so poor, and they are underdeveloped entwicklungsland. They have political bad systems like the caste system and all these things. And then under the big pressure also from China, who approached such quickly, India then decided in the middle of the 90s to, there was the first prime minister who was professor for economy. And he in a certain way was very welcome from the West. And there in a certain way the globalization. So we have 30 years of strong globalization now, if you go today to India. And that means for most countries that they want to, in a way, make in 30 years a quick history of Europe over 500 years. And this means you are in a high turbo capitalistic system. Yeah. So they want to, we don't want to be called anymore the underdeveloped. And now they want to develop in 30 years a history of 300 years. And this means you have mostly the much higher capitalistic system. Today, they are in most parts of India, you find in Austria, Germany.
Maybe a bit off topic, but is this decolonization approach of the far left, as described, of the far right, as described, is it also trying to somehow reverse this capitalism, or is it, does it focus
on? You know, everything is very complicated. Yeah. That's always the first truth. If you say it's complicated, you know somebody is telling the truth. That's the first thing. So you have to think that in some countries in India where so Marxism had a strong influence. Yeah? But I think they had, they are always very in competition with China. And this is also so in a certain way they have chosen, as they say, to have a democratic Western system. Yeah? But Marxism has, like in all these so-called colonized countries, a strong voice in India also. So you have a lot of unions, and in the very strong unions, you have countries who are ruled by Marxists most of the times, Kerala, Bengal, in the north Bengal, and in the south Kerala, they are usually communist party ruled. Yeah? So it makes a very big difference in which part of India you are politically, and so yeah? So after the so-called independent, because Marxist, and of course then you have the strong subaltern studies, which probably became one of the most important discourses in philosophy today, yeah? The post-colonial, which first named subaltern studies. Spivak and all these people came out of this movement. And this was already a decolonization in India against Marx. These were Marxists who did something similar to the Chinese, to Mao. Because, so that's the background of colonial studies. Yeah? So this was, by the way, one of the leaders of this discourse has married an Austrian woman. And I don't know whether he still lives. Or it was decided, so he lived in Austria for a long time. And what was the peak? So they were usually Marxists, but said Marx is also Western. So what the analysis of Marx did work probably for the European industrialized countries, but not for farm countries like India or China. So this is why Chinese Marxism was always a way of how do we treat the farmers, not the industrial workers in the factories, yeah, like in Europe. So subaltern and post-colonial, now the left, subaltern post-colonial, decolonizing discourses came. How can we give a voice to the farmers in India and to the importance of their way of pushing the British out of the country? That was the big thing of this time. So they were very strongly connected with the way of what was the important role of the farmers. And this Marx cannot tell us, because this was not a problem of the European countries, which industries which he analyzed. So we have to translate Marx in a certain way into the conditions of China in Mao and of the subaltern. And then they created their own form of Marxism, which was now not so much the industrial worker in the fabric, but the farmer who are suppressed by the elites. So you have a lot of resistance in India from the so-called Bauernaufstände. And even last year or 1 year before, there was a big Bauernaufstand in India. So the farmers are the strong critical voice in India, not the workers in the industrial worker as well. So these are left-wing political movements, and they were very, very strong in India, and are still very, very strong today. So the organization of the farmer resistance.
Sorry to push back on the political dimension of the scriptures. I just wanted to ask you, when you say that this space of the heart is, once you reach the space of the heart, it's where the Kastine system dissolves, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Did you mean it as an instrument? That's the first question. Like this scripture as an instrument of power, so as to govern, so as to pitch this as an idea. Once you reach this space, then it doesn't matter that you are oppressed or that you are Did you mean it in this way?
Yeah, sure, that's always, thank you. That's always a big thing that this is why also with BGP and the ashrams, I said, I see this critically. Because once the political power comes into these forces, it's always dangerous that they are used and instrumentalized or misused, yeah, for a political purpose. And of course, you could then say, BGP is not very clear about the castes. So they say that, okay, probably it would be quite, so it has been a historical tool that was not so bad. So it was not so bad than the European West would now call it, but they could imagine that in certain historical conditions, we overcome this system. So that's usually their thing. So they would say, okay, but they are not really caste-oriented. Because also politically, this would be no good agenda. Yeah? In order when they want to have really the masters, they cannot so easily just go back to a classical caste system.
But never mind the BGP, like in the old days, but how would the question would be like, how would the lower class, lower caste person who's presumably illiterate, how would they gain access to this knowledge which is kind of made to govern them?
Yeah, that there I would say, because we in Western, this is why Buddhism is so popular, because of course it comes politically much closer to criticize the casteism, but we have, this is why I would say we have in the Hindu tradition also systems which did reject the caste system, and one is the tantric system. And I find the tantric system for us very important because to learn also something about it, because it was not just saying sentences like the one I quoted officially, but also the tantric were the tradition, much more than the Buddhist tradition to my knowledge. The tantric were the traditions because they work with things which the Orthodox Brahman, Vedic Brahman would call lower things. So for example, drive, sexuality, women. So the system which includes most were not the Buddhists but were the tantric of lower castes. So many of the ideologies which the tantrics had were coming from lower caste local things. And what is usually said about Kashmir Shaivism in Subarachal is that Kashmir Shaivism became so important because these were high caste Brahmins, like Abhinagupta and all, they were all high caste Brahmins. But they, in a certain way, did something which Brahmins did not before. They started to take the so-called lower rights into the Brahmanic sphere. And therefore, the tantrism was suddenly acceptable for both. So it was originally by indigenous rights, which were not always classical Vedic. Yeah? But these were elite people who then made complicated philosophy. So they started to do what all elites do. They wrote very differentiated systems, philosophies. Abhinagupta is the name of all of them. Many say the second most important philosopher in the Indian tradition, yeah? After Shankara. So he, in a certain way, started to take lower caste and we female connected rights and bring it into the high caste system of the Brahman. And therefore, you had not just a fight between Buddhists and them, but all between some Orthodox Brahmins, which would say, oh, this is really nothing for us, what they are doing now, this even sex rights and all this kind of this. This is usually connected strongly to matriarchal rights. So in the so-called Kaula rites, women take over the primal part. So it's a thing in the tantric sexual rites. It is, and also what is very interesting, that this was a mixture really of caste. So you had in these rites high caste women, and you had women from other castes, which were joining this. So that is a very social-political, very interesting phenomenon. This is why tantrism is for me one of the very interesting traits. And again, tantrism is like Buddhism, or one of the big traditions that runs through the whole history of Indian philosophy. But it culminated or had a peak development in Middle Ages, in our Middle Ages. So the other countries became. And in a certain way, I see the problem with our Aurobindo, the same I see with the tantric philosophy and the political movements right now, that they, in a certain way, I'm quite sure, at least, you know. With our Aurobindo, it's very clear. Modi was in our will. Yeah, on the celebration of the 50 years old. But I think really there it's so obvious what happens. Because they take now Aurobindo to be one of the big nationalist thinkers. But Aurobindo said we should have a nation because of the occupier of the British Empire. So you cannot compare and take his sentences which he was speaking against the British Empire and now take them as evidence of being a nationalist who wants to be. So with Aurobindo you see very typically already the black shadows of what happens when political powers use these people. Because they take simply the sentences totally out of the historical context. And now say, okay, he said we should have an Indian nation. Of course, I hope that when I would have been in India in 1920-30, I would be proud if I would have been a freedom fighter and would have said sentences like, you need an old state. But to take this now as a sentence that he is a hero of Indian BJP nationalism, that is exactly bad science. This is really bad science, because this is really again taking things out totally of context and using them obviously for your own interests. Yeah? So Aurobindo for me is a very good example of the danger when these things, these powers in a certain way try to come together. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to say that because you said that never forget the historic